He's a criminal prosecutor and Mormon historian. She's podcaster and executive director of Sunstone. Join Lindsay Hansen Park and John Dinger for Mormon History, Crime, and Punishment Stories. This is Season 1.
Okay, John, have you ever heard the story about how land was broken up in Salt Lake City after the Mormon settlers arrived? Have you ever heard that story?
Yeah, but aside from forcing the native inhabitants already here out?
Okay, yes. It's more than just colonization. It's actually pretty complicated. As we know, Mormons weren't really great at asking for permission or being collaborative with their neighbors, especially when they arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in the summer of 1847. But there's more to the story than just all the devastation that happened to the native populations here. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. Let's go for it. But you should probably start by explaining the plot system, because that's going to become important later on in this podcast.
Here's the thing. I never thought talking about the plot system of early Mormons would be interesting. But yeah, I actually think it's really interesting. Okay, so what we know is when the Mormons arrive in the Salt Lake Valley, there's nothing there except for sagebrush and native peoples that they didn't know at the time. It looked pretty empty to them. So they come in and they make a makeshift camp that first winter, and then they start to settle in and build. But when you're building like a kingdom of God, this is what the saints thought they did. They were building a kingdom of God. The question is, who lives where? How do we map out a city? What does the city of God look like? Actually, we know something about that. In fact, John, why don't you just read what church historian Ron Anderson says about the allotment system, because I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ron Anderson writes, "By August 20th, 1847, the survey of Plat A was completed. It included 114 10-acre blocks, each containing 8 lots. Lots were 10 by 20 rods, or 165 by 330 feet, basically about 1.25 acres in size. Each block alternated in the way the lots were divided and the houses faced. Only one house was permitted on each lot and had to be 20 feet off the street. Streets were 8 rods, 132 feet wide. Each applicant was assigned property by Heber C. Kimball and Thomas Bullock." And so Bullock maintained a record of the land distribution. A fee of $1.50 was paid for each lot acquired. Each person's receipt for the land became his deed for the purpose of maintaining his claim and the conveyance of the land in the future. Unmarried men were not given an allotment, but polygamists were entitled to receive one for each family. Within days, the lots in Plat A had been distributed. The desire for land wasn't satisfied. Plat B, containing 63 additional blocks east of Plat A, was surveyed and readied for distribution during 1848. Plat C was soon added to Plats A and B. In February 1849, the three were divided into 19 ecclesiastical wards, a bishop presiding over each ward. Under the supervision of each bishop, fences and irrigation ditches were constructed for the benefit of all ward members. Any disputes which arose as a result of this system of land distribution were resolved by the ecclesiastical authority of the church.
Okay, so I just got to say something about what you just said. I, host a different podcast, Year of Polygamy, where we talk about polygamy and Mormonism, and I always say everything in the church has to do with polygamy. This is another evidence of it. They were giving plots of land to polygamists and not to monogamists. Is that how you read that?
That's how I read it, or at least they got priority.
Okay, so that's going to come in later, handy later in this story. But I want everyone to envision this. So the saints arrive in the Salt Lake Valley. It's just sort of what they perceive as an empty valley. They set up this plot system and they get to work. They give it out according to religious doctrine. Polygamists get more land. And at first they sort of live with this garden plot system. But they had drawn up plans to have a new city plot in 1870. So within a few decades, they start changing their plans. Because the railroad was coming and the city would have to expand for the change that the railroad would bring. The railroad coming through Salt Lake City would make it a legitimate crossroads of the West. And Brigham Young knew this, and he wanted the city to reflect that. So territorial legislators at the time described the city as being 57.16 square miles in 1860, which, just for reference, was bigger than all of the contemporary American cities except for Washington, D.C., San Diego, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. So Brigham really saw making Salt Lake City a big place to go.
Right. And the idea was to follow founder Joseph Smith's vision of the city of Zion, with the temple block as the beating heart and religious center of the city.
Yeah, that's important. And historian Jennifer L. Lund and J. Clifton Spenlove say in their Guide to Salt Lake City in 1870, quote, "Before the Brigham Young Company left to return to winter quarters, church leaders were allowed to choose lots for their families. Most selected city plots near the temple block. The rest of the lots were distributed the following summer. There were so many new immigrants, however, that an additional plat B of 63 blocks had to be laid out, and a third section, plat C of 84 blocks, was added in 1849. Although it is commonly believed that lots were distributed by lottery, it is apparent that they were probably distributed either by choice or assignment because of the large number of family members and friends who received property in the same area, so it seems like they built families by who you knew. After 1849, lots were assigned by bishops who presided over the wards in which vacant lots were located. Now stay with me. This might seem like we're talking about a lot, but this is going to come in handy for the series later on. So land was only distributed to adults with families, and the first settlers received these lots as a spiritual stewardship or inheritance, according to Brigham Young. He said, quote, "For the Lord has given it to us without price." And new landowners were required only to pay the filing fee of $1.50. Since the Great Basin was part of Mexico until 1848, known to the nation as Upper California, no American land laws applied until Utah became a territory with the Compromise of 1850. There would be no legal landholding recognized by the federal government in Salt Lake City until the establishment of the Town Charter of 1872. Up until that time, only local deeds applied. During the time of the model, Salt Lake City was occupied by squatters in the eyes of the federal government, which also included Mormons.
Yeah, and again, this is all important because we are going to talk about an extra legal case today that starts over this land conflict.
We're going to do that. Can we do that now? I really want to talk about this story.
Yeah, let's get into it. Let's talk about the murder of Dr. Robinson, a non-Mormon surgeon who was beat to death by Mormon men after he tried to get some property.
And the subsequent lynching of Thomas Coleman.
The murder of Dr. Robinson in Salt Lake City, was it Mormon versus Gentile? On the 25th, we had by telegraph the news of the murder of Dr. Robinson, a Gentile, in Salt Lake City, with the statement that the Gentiles generally were panic-stricken. The Salt Lake Vedette, a Gentile publication, speaking of the murder, says, "The public mind was so entirely engrossed with the sad and terrible event of Monday night as to exclude outside of the absorbing topic any information that would be of interest in our local column. This atrocious act, which is fully commented upon in another column of our present issue, has awakened in the minds of our citizens the inquiry as to why this invariable absence on every occurrence of this nature of those who are employed and paid to guard the peace of this city? Why is it that a citizen, following the instincts of his nature, and in the performance of his duty professionally, leave his bed at night on an errand of mercy and humanity, can be assassinated on a bright, clear night in one of the most public thoroughfares of this city with impunity, and citizens called from their dwellings by the cries of the victim are compelled to traverse street after street without meeting one of these guardians of the night, who, if engaged in the prosecution of their duty, might have arrested the perpetrators of such infamous deeds. This neglect on the part of the authorities demands explanation, and calls loudly for redress. If the lives and property of our citizens are not protected by those whose duty it is, then let them know it, and perhaps some means may be devised by which they can protect themselves. We look for some measures being taken to ferret out the perpetrators of this most damnable outrage." It would be the sheerest hypocrisy to attempt to disguise that this outrage has not merely cast a gloom, but a thrill of horror and a deep, outspoken feeling of distrust and insecurity among the entire so-called Gentile part of the community. When such a man as Dr. Robinson, who is believed to have had no personal enemy in the country, can be coldly and murderously waylaid and shot down by a band of assassins, what citizen can avoid the feeling that his turn may come next? These feelings find expression on every hand, and a thousand rumors are afloat, arising out of the circumstances of this case. We refrain from commenting further at this time, in the hope, feeble though it be, that the investigation today may develop facts rather than suspicions. The inquiry is on every tongue. If the civil authorities cannot give protection to our citizens, and assassinating our best citizens cannot be punished, will the government stand idle until our streets run with blood? A heavy load of responsibility rests somewhere for these repeated outrages, and this last act of iniquity has stirred the sensibilities and horror of the Gentile community. Our citizens to be marked for slaughter, and crime on crime run riot in our midst without hope, without redress? We call on the authorities in the name of humanity and law to ferret out and punish the evildoers. The vedette here hints that the murder was committed with the connivance of the authorities, and that it forebodes danger to all Gentiles. The Telegraph, the Mormon organ, repudiates these ideas and conveys the impression that the questions between Mormons and Gentiles had nothing to do with the murder. Quote, "It now becomes the duty of every good citizen, having a regard for the welfare of society and the lives of his fellow creatures as well as of his own, to see that the perpetrators of this heinous sin against God and man should suffer the penalty of an ignominious death. We but express the universal sentiment of the people of this city when we brand this crime as one which receives their deepest condemnation, a crime at once so atrocious and unnatural that as members of the community they feel it a sacred duty not only to condemn it, but to aid in bringing the murderer or murderers before the law to expiate with their lives for their crimes. And while the public is now engaged in speculations as to the why and wherefore of this shocking tragedy, we listen on the streets to many who, like ourselves, struck with awe at such an exhibition of cruelty and crime, could arrive at no conclusion. Dr. Robinson for a long time has had a controversy with the city authorities over the possession of the warm springs to the north of the city, and thereby gained for himself the name of a very foolish man, and was not unfrequently the butt of ridicule. But beyond that, we know of no one who had anything to say about him. As a physician, he was skillful, and so respected, but to anything of his social life, habits, and associations, we expect the public were as ignorant as we have been. Here is where we are at a loss to account for his fearful end. Had any one individual, or any number, personal ends to serve by his death, we fail to discover them. We cannot name any of his acts and say, these certainly could have been the motives, without insulting the community and blushing for our own baseness. We cannot think of anything in which was interested that could affect anyone else, or even think of propounding a question on it without apologizing for such a thought. Had he been a seducer, like some whose name are a hissing byword, we could have readily seen the point and recorded his death like that of a dog. But there is no possible heard of motive for this foul deed, so far as the deed may be attributed to any one of this community. We can see reason for friends of the community preserving his life, but we can see none for destroying it. His controversy with the city was virtually ended by the decision of Chief Justice Titus last Wednesday, and apologize here we must for the allusion to that act, or to any other of the doctor as a possible contingency leading in any way to his death. We shall not insult our readers with the expression of a thought that anyone with sense enough to be claimed as a citizen could possibly commit the fearful crime." End quote.
What you just heard is an actual article from a publication in California written November 2nd, 1866 in the Daily Alta California, Volume 18. What they are talking about here is a story that would make national news and put the Mormons in a very unwanted spotlight.
Yeah, at this time, the country was moving west. The Civil War had just finished, and people were looking to forget and start anew. Passage through Salt Lake City, the heart of Mormonism, became a sometimes necessary stop, but fear of the Mormons made people hesitate.
It's interesting because the way that we grew up, John Dinger and I both grew up, Mormon, still Mormon, and we were told that everybody loved Mormons, but that's not how people viewed Mormons, was it, John?
Not at all, especially back in the 1800s.
So in the early 1860s, Brigham Young begins to aggressively pursue the railroad coming through Utah. Like we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, he really saw this as a way that it would legitimize the territory. He was convinced it would bring in cash and converts into the area, but unfortunately, this was just after the Mountain Meadows Massacre. So 1860s, the massacre happens in 1857. For those who don't know, it's a group of Mormons in southern Utah who harassed and massacred an entire wagon train of innocent Gentiles. 120 men, women, and children, over 8 were slaughtered in cold blood, basically. And the remaining children were, quote, adopted out to Mormon families until the government could retrieve them. So that was 1857, just a few years before Young's railroad bid. So it's not really great press for him.
Yeah. And one thing you're going to find throughout this whole podcast series is how poor the Mormons' timing was. And so this is just another example of that.
Is there a good timing for a massacre?
I see your point. But right after this, it sent rumors all over the nation that the Mormons, the religious fanatics pushed to the edges of the frontier because of their violent practices, were not safe to all outsiders.
Of course, this prompts writers, journalists, and military to come and write of their own experiences with Mormons. So we have a lot of sources like this. Often people like Thomas Kane as a Union Army colonel and general, he would write favorably about the Mormons. He tried to help the Mormons, even though he wasn't one of them, but others were not as kind.
This is Ryan Flake, and I'm reading a clip from the Dawson's Fort Wayne Daily Times, Fort Wayne, Indiana, Saturday, February 21st, 1863, page 4. The complicity of the church dignitaries, mayors of cities, and other territorial officials in the crimes that have been committed demonstrate that these crimes were church crimes, and Brigham is the head of the church. Armed with unbounded power over the hearts and lives of the people, Brigham defiantly drives the barbaric chariot of Mormon robbery, murder, polygamy, and incest over all law, in defiance of all federal officials in the territory. Brigham not only controls the legislature, but he controls the courts. He uses the one to aid in the other. These facts he proceeded to prove. This attempt of the Mormons to interfere with the administration of the law and control the courts has been one of the chief causes of difficulty between the judges sent by the federal government to Utah and the Mormon people. From almost 20 judges sent to the territory, with the exception of 2, Judge Zembabel Snow, a Mormon, and J.F. Kinney, the present Chief Justice, is the only territorial judge who had not been removed by the present administration. And he bears the unenviable reputation of being the, quote, creature and tool of Brigham Young. The testimony has been uniformly to the effect that the laws could not be enforced. Not one of these judges, with the 2 above named, have been enabled to serve out the short term of 4 years. Some have left in disgust, while others were driven away by force.
This is Erica Rebstock, and I'm reading a clip about the Mormons from the New York Times, New York, New York, the 13th of March, 1863, Friday, page 4. War with the Saints. A telegram from Salt Lake City the other day made the announcement, unexpected by most people, that a collision between the military and the Mormon citizens of Utah was imminent, that the governor of the territory had ordered the arrest of the prophet, and that the saints were in arms to prevent it. Our correspondence from Utah for some time past has indicated that there was trouble brewing in that quarter. Governor Harding, during his brief term of office, has become very offensive, officially and personally, to the Mormons. His inaugural speech was directly in antagonism with their religious prejudices social customs, and political proclivities, and were especially severe upon polygamy. The Mormons were aroused. Brigham Young was wroth. The people convened at the tabernacle denounced the Gentile governor and demanded his removal, as well as that of the two territorial associate justices. It's possible that latterly they have interfered with his exercise of his official functions, and he, being backed by some of the regular troops and by the Regiment of California Volunteers, which recently defeated and exterminated the Hiccup Indians in the battle on Bear River, thought proper to assert and maintain by force his legitimate authority. We suppose that thus far nothing has come of the matter but a general row, for though we have the telegram to Salt Lake, we have not had a dispatch since the beginning of the week. It is fortunate indeed in such a crisis we have the Pacific telegram, for we can thus promptly render justice and make concession from Washington on the one hand, or on the other, reinforce our Utah army from California, Nevada, and Colorado, and prepare for war before the Mormons get the advantage of us. We most earnestly trust, however, that there will be no difficulty in Utah, now or never. We do not believe there is any necessity for it, as all our disputes with the saints are capable of pacific adjustment for the time being, and it is not in the nature of things that they should last long. We learn from Washington that a cabinet meeting was held yesterday to discuss the matter, and that Governor Nye of Nevada was before it, and urged the most relentless rigor with the Mormons. It is always the part of wisdom, however, to exhaust every pacific means of settling a dispute before the bloody abatement is resorted to. And we may be sure that at this crisis, neither the government nor the people are disposed to fall foul needlessly or heedlessly of another Mormon war. The national authority must, of course, be sustained in Utah as elsewhere. Mormon rebels must be crushed, as well as slaveholding rebels. Sedition is as odious among the saints as among sinners, but we must not be in haste to accuse of treason those who claim to be loyal, nor lend to the sanction of the government, to all the injustices, acts of a green and pragmatical frontier functionary. The very fact that the Mormons have got up a petition for his removal would indicate their desire for subordination to the authority of the government and their anxiety for a peaceful settlement of the dispute. Let the government treat these people justly while firmly. The whole Mormon question, once so formidable and so full of warlike portents, is rapidly solving itself. The vast territory of Utah which they possessed has been vastly reduced in size within the last year or two. Colorado has taken part of it on the east. Nevada has taken part of it on the west. Idaho is taking part of it on the north. The isolation of the Mormons, too, exists no more. Populous communities of Gentiles are growing up on each side of them and crowding them closer and closer. Gentiles even form a good part of Utah itself. Thus, the sect is settling down merely as a sect among sects and losing its character of a great and distinct political, territorial, social, and religious organization. In a few years, by these causes, the Mormons will be entirely swallowed up. This is the solution we hope to see to the Mormon problem. It is much better, cheaper, and more honorable than will be the effort to subjugate them by military force.
This is Mindy Mae Farmer, and I'm reading a clip about Mormons from the Moyle News Dealer, Hyde Park, Vermont, 26th of July, 1865, Wednesday, page 1. Your readers are aware, I suppose, that a large proportion, perhaps the majority of the people of Utah, are foreigners, recruits by missionaries sent out over the whole world. The larger proportion are English, from the factory towns of Great Britain, but Germans, Swedes, Finns, Scotch, Icelanders, and even East Indians are here. Mr. Young boasts that 50 different nationalities are represented among his people. The bulk of them all of the peasantry, the lower classes of working people at home. And so the congregations of the Mormons do not exhibit the marks of high acuteness and intelligence. The audiences at the tabernacle today and last Sunday, and at the theater last night, were what would be called common-looking people. The handsome girls were few, and fine-looking women fewer. Intelligent, strong-bearded men were more numerous, but the great mass, both in size, looks, and dress, was below the poorest, hardest-working, and most ignorant classes of our eastern large towns. The gatherings and the services, both speaking and singing, reminded me of the Methodist camp meetings 15 or 20 years ago. The singing, as on the latter occasions, was the best part of the exercises, simple, sweet, and fervent. Daughters of Zion was sung by the large choir last Sunday, was prayer, sermon, song, and all. The preaching last Sabbath was by Mr. Samuel W. Richards, who is of Massachusetts origin, but has been a Mormon leader and missionary for many years. Beyond setting forth the superiority of the Mormon church system, through its presidents, councils, bishops, elders, and 70s, for the work made incumbent upon Christians, and claiming that its preachers were inspired like those of old, his discourse was a rambling, unimpressive exhortation, such as you hear from a tonguey deacon in any country Baptist or Methodist meeting house. The Bible, both Old and New Testament, is used with the same authority as by all Protestants. The Mormon scriptures are simply new and added books confirming and supplementing the teachings of the original scriptures. The rite of the sacrament is administered every Sunday, water being used instead of wine, and the distribution proceeding among the whole congregation, men, women, and children, and numbering from 3 to 5,000, while the singing and the preaching are in progress. The prayers are few and simple, undistinguishable, except in these characteristics, from those heard in all Protestant churches. And the congregation all join in the Amen. Brigham Young's preaching today was a very unsatisfactory, disappointing performance. There was every incentive to him to do his best. He had an immense audience, spread out under the Bowery, to the number of 5,000 or 6,000. Before him was Mr. Colfax, who had asked him to preach upon Mormon doctrines. Around him were all his elders and bishops, in unusual numbers. And he was fresh from the exciting discussion of yesterday on the subject of polygamy. But his address lacked logic, lacked effect, lacked holy magnetism or impressiveness. It was a curious medley of scriptural exposition, exhortation, bold and bare statement, coarse denunciation, vulgar allusions, cheap rant, and poor cant. So far as his statement of Mormon belief went, it amounted to this, that God was a human material body, with like flesh and blood, and passions to ourselves, only perfect in all things. And he begot his son Jesus in the same way that children are begotten. That Jesus and the Father looked alike, and were alike, distinguishable only by the former being older. That our resurrection would be material, and we should live in heaven with the same bodies and the same passions as on earth. That Mormonism was the most perfect and true religion. That those Christians who are not Mormons would not necessarily go to hell and be burned by living fire and tortured by ugly devils, but that they would not occupy as high places in heaven as the Latter-day Saints. That polygamy was the habit of all the children of God in the earlier ages and was first abolished by the Goths and Vandals who conquered and constructed Rome. That Martin Luther approved of it, in a single case at least. That a clergyman of the Church of England once married a man to a second wife while his first was living. And that in England now, if a man wanted to change his wife, he had only to offer her at auction and knock her off for a pot of beer or a shilling and marry another. This last statement called out a voice of dissent from an English working face in the audience. A good deal of boasting of the success of the Mormons, their temperance, frugality, and sharp denunciations of the few stinking lawyers who lived down in Whiskey Street and for $5 would attempt to make a lie into a truth were the only other noticeable features of this discourse of the president of the Church of Latter-day Saints. It was a very material interpretation of the statements and truths of Scripture, very illogically and roughly rendered, and calculated only to influence a cheap and vulgar audience. Brigham Young may be a shrewd businessman, an able organizer of labor, a bold, brave person in dealing with the practicalities of life. He must indeed be all of these, for we see the evidence all around this city and country. But he is in no sense an impressive or effective speaker, judged by any standards that I have been accustomed to.
Honestly, this was the easiest internet search I ever performed. Like, finding terrible things people were saying about Mormons in the 1860s is like shooting fish in the barrel. I was like, I wonder what the nation thought of the Mormons while Brigham Young was trying to get the railroad. And I literally picked the articles that you just heard from the first result page on the search engine.
I bet. But it makes me wonder what all the rest have to say.
Let's just say that people thought of Mormons as a completely different species.
Yeah, I mean, you're not far off. Paul Reeve argues in his excellent book, Religion of a Different Color, that Mormons were seen as a separate and different racial group.
It's true. That's such a fascinating idea for me. And you guys should definitely check out that book. But I mean, just look at one of those clips that we read. The racism at the time condemned Mormons for being a community made up of many different nations. That was seen as a bad thing.
Yeah, this is when globalism was still cool with the Mormons.
Well, I mean, we are a global church, but it doesn't always feel like that. Oh my gosh, I just said Phil. Did you hear that?
No, what?
I just said it doesn't always feel like that instead of feel. So I'm such a hypocrite. So Utah Mormon. I can't even global. I'm so Utah-centric. I apologize for my Utah accent. Sometimes it doesn't feel like that.
You are definitely Mormon then.
Okay, so we talked about Mountain Meadows Massacre already, but the question really is this. The narrative you and I grew up with, Dinger, of as LDS Mormons was that our Mormon pioneers were stalwart, good, honest people, kind and giving and generous.
Oh, yeah.
In church, we heard these stories in church. They told us how great our ancestors were all the time in church.
Absolutely. These are the church-sanctioned stories. All of them painted our ancestors as, well, saints.
I mean, that's what we are called. It's in our name. Why would we be any different?
Well, there is a reason or two that people thought Mormons were dangerous.
Okay, but why? Because they were dangerous to outsiders? Because they massacred a wagon train?
Well, that for sure, yeah, but it goes a step further. It's not just that Mormons were dangerous to outsiders, it's that they worked outside the law.
You mean that they couldn't be controlled by the law?
Well, not only they couldn't be controlled by the law, but they made up their own law. In their minds, they were following the law. They had their own justice system. Let's call it mountain law.
Ah, mountain law, that phrase, it sounds so bad, eh? Can we just call this podcast Mountain Law?
Well, we could, but this story starts back before the Mormons even dreamed of going to the mountains. This started back at the beginning.
Oh my gosh. Okay, this is such a huge topic. How are we going to fit this in the series? We had to narrow it down, especially with Dinger, who is a criminal prosecutor. This is his wheelhouse. So we have gone through a ton of sources and we've tried to put it into one series. And what did we land on, Dinger?
Extra legal justice in Utah and the West. Things outside the law. There are a lot of stories like this in Mormonism, but we're going to tell them so that when we tell you about the murder of Dr. Robinson, you'll understand exactly why this story is so compelling.
Okay, so you remember that article we read at the very beginning of the episode? It's one of the most underappreciated murders in Utah history, in Mormon history, really. This murder of Dr. Robinson affected everything. It's a huge deal, and I never really heard about it growing up, but it impacted a lot of things.
As we will talk about later.
Yes, we'll talk about it later. We need to put a pin in that story. I don't want to, but keep a pin in the story at the murder of Dr. Robinson. Sort of. Put it up on your proverbial shelf for a bit.
We're good at putting things on shelves.
Yes, we are. We're very practiced at that, so you should be able to do that.
Yeah, so keep this story in the back of your minds because we are going to tell you the stories of extra legal justice in Mormonism.
Each story we are telling, we specifically selected to highlight a different aspect of extra legal justice in Mormonism. And this is actually to John Dinger's credit because he's the one that brought this up when we were talking about doing a true crimes in Mormonism. There are so many directions we could go, but we narrowed down extra legal because when woven together, these stories give a fascinating context to why Mormon culture and doctrine is the way it is today. So stay tuned.
Sunstone depends on your generous support. Please sign up for a recurring donation at sunstone.org and support this and many other projects.